let's say you've got one spouse that's making $100,000, another spouse that's making $50,000. The spouse that's making $100,000 on a community property state tax return, they're actually only going to report $75,000 worth of taxable income. It's completely legitimate because they're just following state laws as far as distribution of income.
For today's episode, I want to start off with a couple of the reader questions or the listener questions that we've had asked to us with our voicemail over the past couple weeks. So remember that this is a wonderful way that you can get your questions answered for free, and it can be really about anything, student loans, investing. I guess if you want to ask about life, go ahead. But I can't promise to have the answers. But if it's about one of those first two things, I think we'll have some really helpful ideas. This first question, and by the way, you can leave a voicemail question for the show at studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. So the first question comes from Anonymous.
Hi, Travis. I was sending in a voicemail to ask you to help me convince my husband to refinance his Parent PLUS loans. As a background, he is about $2,000 in an institutional loan from our undergrad institution, about $20,000 in pretty low interest federal student loans, and then Parent PLUS loans, he has about $70,000 in Parent PLUS loans. Now, those are in his mom's name, but they had always agreed upon him paying those back monthly over a 10-year payment plan. He currently pays about $1,000 a month on just those Parent PLUS loans, and all of them are in the 7% interest range. Just from some background information and quotes I've gotten, he could get a new loan just for those Parent PLUS loans in the 4 to 5% range, and it would save us a pretty significant amount of money. He's a little nervous to do this because it would increase our debt-to-income ratio. And if we were to decide to get a mortgage, he's concerned that having that added debt in his name would prevent us from getting a mortgage. My personal feeling is that if we were to refinance and save a pretty significant amount of interest, that would be a bigger deal. And I don't think that getting that debt in his name would prevent us from getting a mortgage. Just hoping for some of your thoughts and maybe a little bit of backup as I try to convince him. Thank you.
Okay, that's a great question. So this person is looking to convince her husband to refinance Parent PLUS loans. What that means, and based off of what I heard in that question, the Parent PLUS loans actually are not in his name. They're in the name of a parent. And that is how Parent PLUS loans work. A lot of people talk about my Parent PLUS loans, but guess what? They're actually not your Parent PLUS loans. I've even had some parents that have had kind of handshake agreements with their kids, and then the kids can't get jobs. And then suddenly the parents are trying to sue the kids to get out of the debt they signed up for because it's not in the name of the kid, it's in the name of the parent. So that's real interesting. That's a little fun little tidbit about that. And Parent PLUS loans, how do those work? Well, you know how you can take out an unlimited sum of money for graduate school with the Grad PLUS program? So the Parent PLUS program allows you to take out an unlimited amount of money for student loans for undergrad. So if you're an undergrad student, luckily the government says the minimum age to screw over your financial life is 22, not 18, because as an 18-year-old going to undergrad, you cannot take out more than, I believe it's $57,500, even as an independent student in Stafford loans. It's just not possible. And Parent PLUS is a way to bypass that and take out the maximum allowed for your school, right? And the thing is parents can borrow for multiple children. So you might have one mom with like three different kids that she's borrowed for have $200,000 of Parent PLUS loans split up 70, 70, 60K or something, you know, weird like that. And so if you think about that, here's the challenge that I would give. Is this the mom's only form of debt? You know, if that's true, then you would probably want to refinance this and take it over. So let's assume that it is for a moment. So what you would do is you would actually do a refinancing on you could go on our site, studentloanplanner.com/refi, R-E-F-I, and you're going to see all the best bonuses there. You're going to see Common Bond and Laurel Road are the two that are the easiest to deal with for Parent PLUS loan refinancing, and you probably could get some level of a cash bonus as well. But the main benefit here is obviously cutting the interest rate, because if you go from a 7% to a 5%, on a 70K loan, you're saving like $1,400 a year. It's just, you know, that you're no longer flushing down the toilet. So that's pretty cool. You do the refinancing, but I think there's a way for you two to compromise. Instead of signing up for a 10-year refinancing where your monthly payment's going to be $700 a month plus whatever the 20K that you have in your own name, that is not going to bother you with your mortgage, because what they're going to do is they're going to look at your mortgage and they're going to look at basically, is your amount of your debt, amount of your income going to debt payments? Is that below you know, a certain percentage, right? And so that $900 or $700 a month payment is going to kind of count against you for that. But guess what? That's not a problem if you buy a house two times your joint income. If you do that, then a 10-year refinancing is fine. What I would probably do in this case, though, is I'd probably do a 20-year refinancing ladder strategy. So that means instead of signing up for a $700 a month payment for this, maybe you sign up for a $400 payment on a 20-year term. Maybe instead of getting a 4% interest rate, you get a 5% interest rate. But what you do is you pay way extra over and above what you have to pay. And then the bank is not going to be concerned about you being required to pay way more than what's listed, right? So the bank's going to be very calm about a $400 a month payment. And they're going to see that that is going to get paid down really fast. You're going to want to pay that down as fast as possible. And then you could refinance it again once it's down to $40,000 into a 10-year term with a $400 a month payment. So that's the refinancing ladder strategy. It's basically like, I want to cut my interest rate. I don't want to freak out because my payment's too high. I want multiple cashback bonuses. I want to refinance multiple times and get interest savings every time I do it. That's what the refi ladder strategy is all about. And that was one of the strategies really that we kind of created in terms of how we described it. I'm proud of this strategy. I think it's the way to go here. I think that you just want to do a refinance ladder strategy with this. And a lot of you listening need to do that if you're, you know, if you're in a private sector job and you have a really solid income compared to what you owe. And just one last point about this Parent Plus situation. If your mom had multiple children that she had sent to college and had a bunch of debt from that experience, then you might actually rationally choose to have her go for a forgiveness strategy. And you could get power of attorney on her loan accounts, send in her income certification, and she could pay, you know, a couple hundred dollars a month on a monster balance for like 25 years. And remember, federal debt's forgiven tax-free upon death. And you can also just consolidate it and restart the clock if mom makes it to 95 because she, you know, kind of morbid, but she's probably not going to make it to like 120. So there's all kinds of stuff that you can do with Parent Plus debt. So I think that the right thing to do is to refinance it, but there's a little bit more to it than that. We've also got a question from Tyler, who's a family medicine resident, about when to consolidate and also community property rules in terms of choosing the right plan from the get-go.
Hi, Travis. I'm a medical student starting a family medicine residency next year, and I wanted to get your opinion on starting with repay during residency and switching afterwards once you're an attending. My thought is I want to do payee after residency for sure because I live in a community property state and my wife currently does not work. And if she does, probably wouldn't make more than $70,000 per year starting off anyway. And so I'm thinking that payee might be just better to start off even during residency, even though that's not the traditional advice. And with the thought being that if anything could change where you couldn't switch, like it would really hurt me to not be in pay for 10 years if I do PSLF or the 20 years if I don't. Again, I have a $450,000 student loan debt, you know, projected to make anywhere from $200,000 to $250,000 afterwards, depending on whether or not I take a PSLF eligible employment or not. So the thought is I would just do payee from the beginning of residency, right after loan consolidation at the day of graduation, and then just take the loss of the interest subsidy in those 3 years and just to be kind of secured, locked in on the payee without losing any months to when you change plans, and also just to be secured in that position since it has such a huge benefit on the community property state side of things. Love to hear if you think I'm making a big mistake by foregoing those 3 years on repay during residency or not. Thank you.
So one thing we can say about a family medicine doc is you're not going to make $500,000 a year unless there's something really weird that happens to your career. You know that you're going to be making $200,000 to $300,000 adjusted upwards for inflation. And so the reality here is, are you going to do a, you know, PSLF strategy or are you going to not? Are you going to work for a private practice? If you do work for a private practice, then what this listener is talking about is in community property states such as California, Washington State, Texas, Arizona, et cetera, you actually evenly distribute your income across both spouses' tax returns. And so if one spouse makes 70, the other spouse makes 200, are at, let's say, 230 to make the math easy, right? Combined income is 300, but if you filed separately, you pay on half of that. So you pay on 150K of taxable income instead of 300. So that turns this debt to income ratio into 3-to-1 debt to income ratio situation. And then this person could go for taxable loan forgiveness instead of PSLF if they do private practice. So here's the way I would think about this. The interest subsidy is really not that important in this case. The only reason you'd want an interest subsidy is for the probability that you go out and refinance your loans one day. And if that's a low probability event, which it certainly sounds like it is in this case, why would you worry about the interest subsidy instead of being able to do the pay-as-you-earn plan and exclude your spouse's income using these community property rules? That's just more important here. So I would start off by, when can you consolidate? The answer is as soon as your financial aid office has updated your status with the federal government to graduated. Usually that takes maybe a week or two after graduation, from my experience. Literally, somebody in the financial aid office has to send in kind of a data dump to the federal government saying, yep, this is the list of people that are graduated that should be entering repayment. That's when you should do it. So really, like a week or two after graduation is as soon as you can consolidate. And in this case, if you did do repay, then you do have to switch to pay later on, and you're going to lose 1 month of downtime while you're switching plans, right? And that downtime you're going to lose on is this payment of $300 a month as a resident instead of $2,000-$3,000 a month as an attending. So right there, that's a $2,000 or $3,000 mistake if you end up not pursuing PSLF from having done repay at the very beginning. So the idea here is just go ahead and get on the plan you need to be on and stick with it through thick and thin and don't stress out about it. I really do think that probably everybody living in a community property state probably needs to get a student loan plan just because of how much complexity is involved with making sure that's right. But clearly, this listener has listened to a couple shows and has done his homework. So thanks for that question. Now that we've got the investment course in the books for 2020, for the first part of it at least, I wanted to change gears and bring on one of our newest additions to the Student Loan Planner consulting team, Ben Nanny. Ben, welcome to the show.
Hey, yeah, it's great to be here.
Before we pressed the record button, Ben was giving me a pretty hard time because I used to be a singer and performer back when I was in high school. He and the team kind of found this thing on YouTube and they're sharing it, and apparently it was a big hoot. Hopefully nobody looks at that online because maybe you won't trust my student loan advice.
I think you need to link to it, actually. I mean, it's hilarious. Just for the listeners out there, I mean, he's very talented. It's just, it's a different side of Travis that I didn't know existed.
Everybody has their deep, dark secrets. Mine is I was a performer back in high school. So
not a bad secret.
It was pretty fun. I mean, we traveled all over the place. We did a concert like in the Vatican. My high school group did. We sang in Notre Dame Cathedral. So that was pretty crazy when that fire happened, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Did a concert in St. Paul's Cathedral in London, Pier 39, San Francisco, St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City. Oh, actually, I got to perform for Neil Armstrong and Jim Lovell, too.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah, it was really neat. I was in middle school and I did the Music Man, you know, the Trouble in River City. If anybody's ever listened to a lot of musicals, that was pretty neat. I remember, like, you know, Jim Lovell's the Apollo 13 guy, and I was, you know, a kid, so I could ask more questions and most people probably he would tolerate it better, right? And I was like, would you ever get up in another spaceship again? And he's like, hell no.
At least he was honest.
Yeah, very, very honest. He's like, I'm very happy to be here. And it was pretty cool because, you know, these guys were naval aviators before and they were in my hometown for a naval aviator reunion. So it's kind of cool to think about how every famous person or great person kind of comes from way more humble beginnings, right? So it's a good reminder to never take yourself too seriously. Speaking of that, so Ben, our listeners, you know, some of them, like, we got this one email the other day. This listener was like, Travis, I listened to you. I've listened to 20 podcasts in a row. And I felt like saying, oh, shoot, I'm sorry. But, you know, I listened to 20 podcasts and I have this meeting booked on Tuesday with this guy named Ben. And I don't know anything about Ben. Who is he? And so, Ben, tell everybody a little bit about yourself and explain why we decided to make you one of the newest student loan planner consultants on the team.
Really good question. So actually, I'll let you answer that part, Travis. I'm not really sure exactly why you guys chose me. I felt very honored. So a little bit about my background. I started out in accounting software. For about 6 years, I traveled West Tennessee, basically, and we helped a lot of local governments, so boards of education, mayor's offices, run their accounting systems. We had a specific kind of niche type product. Worked in that for about those 6 years. Transitioned into more general public accounting for about 2 years, where I did audit work, tax work. Then around 2015, I transitioned into a specific wealth management position in a Nashville office. Spent 2 years kind of learning how to manage people's money, good things about money, bad things about money, that sort of thing. Then from there, I went to a fee-only financial planning practice that had two arms. One was a traditional fee-only planning practice where we focused on more the money side of things. And then there was a sister firm that was related to that where we did CPA level work, basically high level tax projections and tax preparation for primarily physicians across the nation. Did that for about a year. And my wife and I had spoken for many, many years about me going out on my own. And so in 2018, we decided it was kind of professionally, financially, we were to the point where it was at that point or it was never going to any better to try to make that leap. And so I officially started my own financial planning firm in April this year, so I'm like 8 months into it, and came in with student loan planner officially in November, just to kind of get some more experience in student loans. And also, I think just to feel like I'm making a difference in people's lives. I think that what we're doing at Student Loan Planner, we have a reach that a lot of traditional financial planning avenues don't reach as well. You know, we've got 1 hour consults with people who, in some of my experience, have never spoken with a financial planner before. And I feel like in that hour, we're really able to make a difference, not just with their student loans, but many times just in their general finances. And for me, that gives me a sense of service. And the fact that we get paid to do it just makes it that much better.
I'll speak to why we wanted to add Ben to the team. I mean, so part of it is to use like a sports analogy. You know, if you have a football team and you have bad wide receivers, you have bad defensive line, like you have a need that you need to go fill, right? It was kind of like that with our student loan planner team. I knew that two areas we were a little bit weak on was knowing tax rules in great detail, and then also knowing paperwork and processes of the way that the student loan servicers do things, knowing that in great detail. Not to say that we don't know a lot about those things, but we were really looking to round out our expertise even more in those areas. And so Megan, who we'll have on the podcast a little bit later, is the other student loan planner consultant that we hired. She has that deep process and paperwork and servicer knowledge. And then Ben, obviously having a CPA background, having the experience that you have in tax, as well as on the CFP's financial planning side, that was very attractive because now we actually have somebody that we can ask, you know, hey, how is this AGI calculated for Social Security, you know, contributions and everything, Social Security income? Like, how does this impact the line 37 or whatever? We actually have somebody for that. So I was really excited for that reason. Also, it's very clear that everybody we look for on the team has to have like a real passion for helping people. And that kind of has to be the primary goal. I think a lot of the people on our team are younger business owners because when you start a financial planning practice, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that you don't have 100 clients paying you 10 grand a year overnight.
Not unless you're a student loan planner, you don't.
Well, you know, we'll take thousands of clients paying us 500 any day.
But no, you're exactly right.
So the idea there is Ben's practice, and what's the current name of the practice, by the way, your practice that you started?
Crossroads Financial Consulting.
I think it should be named like Nomadic Doctors Who Hate Taxes or something like that incorporated. Because that's really what you do is you work with people that have, you know, 1099 income, locum tenens people that are physicians that are trying to maximize their financial planning and their investing, right?
Yes, that's correct.
But, you know, obviously a lot of those folks have a lot of student loan issues. And so I think that that was an area that I could tell that you were capable in. And so we had you get the CSLP Certified Student Loan Professional designation as kind of a crash course to familiarize you with the student loan process. And then we also had you go through our own internal training program. And how many folks have you worked with so far?
Through today, it'll be about 35.
Yeah, we're recording this in mid-December too, so it'll probably be closer to 60 when this comes out. You know, you already have several dozen under your belt, and that's really exciting. So I wanted to start off, kick it off with just a question from a listener. Remember that if you're listening to this, you can submit your own personal questions and get a personal answer for free by just going to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, just like it sounds, and then just recording something 30 seconds on your phone, just speak into it, press the stop button. It's super easy, and it's the best way to get free advice that I know of. Let's pause and let's hear a question from a listener named Brooke.
Hey, Travis. I was wondering how becoming what the IRS considers a highly compensated employee affects AGI and a repay forgiveness plan. I am a physician assistant consultant, and I currently make $119,000, with room to grow at my current company. I also have a business opportunity with a friend next fall. I work for a small company with about 30 providers across multiple states, plus maybe 20 office staff at our main location. I was told by my employer last week that I'm at risk of becoming a highly compensated employee, and that in the future, I may not be able to continue to max out my company's traditional 401k and company Roth 401k. If this becomes the case, how should I go about investing in lowering my AGI for the repay forgiveness plan? I owe about $177,000 in student loan debt. I started following the repay plan after my consultation with Justin last year, and I've been focusing on my investment growth in my taxable and brokerage accounts. Also, will increasing my income with a side gig knock me into the highly compensated employee bracket, even if my full-time job doesn't know about the side gig money? If this business opportunity with my friend goes through and becomes very lucrative, I plan to just use the money to refinance and pay off my student loans. I also still want to be able to max out my taxable retirement accounts if possible.
Okay, so highly compensated employee. So that's like a specific term based off of somebody who's making too much to just contribute the normal way to a retirement plan. And I think that this listener is concerned because she was going for a forgiveness plan and she's doing real good at putting money into her retirement. But now she's thinking that she's not going to be able to lower her taxable income all that much. And so then now she's questioning the whole thing. Like, what do I do now that, you know, we can't get my income below this 1.5 debt to income ratio? Looks like you're going to break through that because of this weird retirement plan rule, right? So can you just kind of recap for our listeners what this actually even means, like the highly compensated employee, and what would happen to you if you ever became one?
First of all, it's a specific thing based on the actual 401k plan. So it's different from plan to plan. And it has to do with how many people are participating in that particular plan. At the end of every year, they have to do testing on that 401k. And so the government has kind of set up these rules to basically say, hey, this 401k plan should be for everyone, not just for the well-paid people. And so they do some different statistical testing that's run by some administrators of that plan. And at the end of every year, they decide whether or not it's been favored toward the high-income people or not. And if it has been favored toward those high-income people, there's some repercussions. And part of those repercussions involve potentially refunding some contributions from those highly compensated people. If it's determined that in Brooke's case that she has contributed an excess amount, that amount would be refunded to her. And because it was deducted on her paycheck when it was contributed, when it's paid back to her, it's going to be taxable. But there's not going to be any penalties on her end. She's just going to be taxable on that excess contribution. Specific to her, I wouldn't let that really bother me. I would just contribute the max. Again, we're recording in 2019. So for 2019, it'd be $19,000 that she could contribute. I would max that out. And if it turns out at the end of the year, if there's plan testing and it's decided that she did have an excess contribution, she can just pay taxes on it anyway, which is what would have happened had she not contributed it. Worst case scenario, she's taxed on something that she would have been taxed on anyway. So I don't think there's a lot for her to worry about. Really where the rub can be is if you're the employer, if they don't handle that excess contribution correctly, there can be a 10% penalty that they have to pay. So I think that's probably the pushback where that's really originating from the employer is they're really concerned more about what's going to happen on their end versus what's really going to affect her.
Yeah. And from my experience, employers care a whole lot about having unexpected penalties that they have to pay. They hate that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's easily avoidable from their end. They just have to report it in a timely manner. But yes, you're exactly right. No one likes penalties.
Here's some deeper level thoughts about this. So she did mention that she had some side income that she might be getting from a friend's business.
Yeah.
This is at the plan level. So she can make a bazillion dollars in some other thing. And that's not going to affect anything about what she's doing with her plan at work, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So there's two components to 401k. There's the contribution limit, and then there's the profit sharing portion. You can only defer a total of $19,000 across whether you've got one 401k or if you've got 10 401ks. You can only contribute the max deferral in a combined amount. But what is separate when you have separate 401k plans is the actual profit sharing portion or the match portion. In her example, if she could only contribute, let's say $15,000 in deferral in her current position, so she's got $4,000 left that she can contribute to that solo 401k deferral. She can defer the $4,000 in deferral, plus she can set a max match of like 20 to 25% on the profit of that sideline business. I guess the short of it is if she's making some money on this sideline income, she should definitely set up a solo 401k and she could contribute up to $57,000 depending on what her profit was for that business for the year.
That's really pretty amazing because a lot of people don't really understand solo 401ks and SEP IRAs. But if you have 1099 income, basically you're getting income from having a business without any employees, then you can contribute, you know, it's real technical, right? It's like 25% of the net profit or something.
Yeah, that's the short end of it, like 25%.
To be honest, I'll tell you what I do. When I started Student Loan Planner and set it up as we're an S corporation, I just ask my accountant every year. I'm just like, what is our wage? What is our net, you know, whatever business income? And then I just ask for that number, which basically any CPA can tell you if you just ask for it. You get that number and then you just take the 25% of it. Now I know what I can put in for my employer matching, right? So I think that's pretty interesting. This is something that a lot more people should listen to and perk up for because that idea about having multiple 401ks, that's a great way to reduce your taxable income. So for example, my wife has her 403b plan through her hospital, and she maximizes that at $19,000 a year. Her employer puts in some money too. That's not counted in the $19,000 that she gets to put in. And then she also helps us out for student loan planners. So we have a solo 401k plan. And so spouses are allowed to be included in a solo 401k. She also gets an employer match from us into her student loan planner solo 401k plan. But we don't contribute anything for the employee part of it because she already does that through her primary job.
That's a very good example. That's exactly right. So what you benefit from having that second solo 401k is you get that extra match, which in your case could be pretty large. That's great.
Right. Yeah. So you could, I mean, in theory, say you have two or three businesses or you have multiple 1099s or something like that. You could set up, like you said, hopefully, goodness sakes, hopefully not 10. Probably the max number you'd want to have at a time is maybe two.
Yeah. A little caveat to that too. And this is getting really specific and it's somewhat out of my expertise, but there can't be like related 401k setup. So for example, you know, if you had two separate 1099s, you want to set up two solo 401ks, they would basically have a combined limit. They would be considered as one for the overall limits because they were under a controlled group because you own both of those.
So that's an example why you need to talk to your tax professional if you're doing some of this real complicated stuff, because it makes a big difference. I mean, if you're able to put away 50 grand, you might save 20 grand on that in taxes. I mean, is that worth going and spending $1,000 or $2,000 to talk to a competent professional about this? Yeah, it is. And it's also why we don't like to do in-depth tax advice, because I think we could go out and hire it. I think Ben obviously could do that. But the real question is what can we be the best in the world at? And that's giving people specific student loan strategies so that they can save the most on that part of their life, right? And we equip you to do a lot more things than just that. That's just a great example of one of the reasons, again, why I wanted you on the team, Ben, is you have a really deep knowledge, a lot of this stuff that's a little bit sometimes out of my wheelhouse as somebody who's not a CPA. And it just gives us a stronger base. You know, back when I started this, it was just me. As good as my hilarious YouTube videos are from 17, when I was singing, like, I don't know that much, right? Like, my talents are limited. Like, they're finite. I'm good at what I'm good at, and I know what I'm not good at. So I'm excited to have you available to ask questions like that. So, you know, in terms of what somebody needs to do, again, like, if you're worried about your income being too high, that's like the exact opposite of what we would want you to worry about. If this person has 180K in student loans, 100K in income, and we generally say, you know, 1.5 debt to income ratio before you refinance. If she starts making like 130, 140 or 150, then yeah, hot dog, pay your loans off, refinance, get one of our bonuses on the site, maybe get a couple of them, you know, refinancing over multiple times over the time you pay it off and get out of debt. We don't want anybody to pursue loan forgiveness. That's not like our goal, right? Is to get somebody to pursue pay as you earn because it makes us more money or something. Our goal is to get people out of debt if it makes sense and to make people view their debt as a tax if we also think it makes sense. So in times, somebody's income changes long term and that's a different path. That's a different financial look and that person should adapt to that and not stress at all about her higher income. At the end of the day, your student loans are a tax until it makes sense to no longer treat it as a tax because you're making so much bank, you just decide that it makes more sense to just treat it as a debt and get rid of it. So that's a perfect example of that kind of a case.
One thing I would add too, I get a lot of questions about, you know, the difference between a SEP IRA or a solo 401k. And really a SEP IRA, it's easier to set up and you can also set it up later. You've got to set up a solo 401k by year end. So if you want to set one up for 2019, you've got to have it basically on record by December 31st. A SEP IRA you can set up after the fact. So you could set one of those up and fund it in April of 2020 for the 2019 tax year. That's one benefit of a SEP IRA. A lot of the reasons why we default to the solo 401k, it's not so much for the extra amount that you can put in because over time, they both cap out. I misspoke. I said 67,000 earlier. It's 56,000. But the big benefit of the solo 401k is if you're going to do backdoor Roth IRAs, which come into play if you're a high income type person, you can't cleanly do a backdoor Roth if you have IRA assets. And so if you're going to do backdoor Roth, you do not want to have a SEP IRA, and a solo 401k kind of skirts that issue for you.
Makes sense. And I heard kind of a controversial take the other day that the value of a backdoor Roth IRA in total basis points is pretty small. For somebody who's a high saver, like for somebody who's a low saver, yeah, like it could be a meaningful thing.
Yeah.
But it's interesting how much we get worked up about things like solo 401k versus SEP and like Roth backdoor, all these things that confuse the heck out of people, but we don't tell them the reality, which is just drive a car that's 10K or less, it's paid off, and then live in a house that's 2 times your joint income, and then try to put the difference in actual investments instead of leaving it in the bank. And really, if you mess up everything else, you'll still be okay if you follow that advice. I'm all for optimizing, you know, because that's obviously the business that we're in. But I guess an analogy for this is like one of my favorite board games is this thing called Axis and Allies. And it takes like 5 hours to play. Probably takes like an hour to set it up and probably an hour to tear down and like at least 3 hours to play it if you know what you're doing. It's kind of like Risk on steroids. And so like there's all these technicalities and I love that. But kind of what happens is nobody wants to play the game with me. It sat in our closet for like 3 years because no one will play the game with me. And it's just because it's too complicated. So the games that people will play with me are things like, you know, Catan that take 35, 40 minutes if you know what you're doing. You know what I mean? Like, you know, just card games that are a lot faster. Like people will play those because they're simple enough to actually play the game. So that's one thing that we always try to kind of keep in the back of our minds is when we're making things so complicated to try to optimize everything. You know, we're, if that board game was student loans, like, you know, we're ready to play the 5 hour game, but we're realizing that, man, if we cause anybody to not play the game because they're hearing, oh gosh, it sounds so complicated, then oh my gosh, I screwed up because we could have had a lot of fun anyway, right? Played something else like Monopoly on it.
No, I 100% agree with that. And in my experience, you're right. I mean, we can kind of nerd out on things that don't really matter when it comes to optimizing, because I do think I was kind of weaned on Dave Ramsey. And, you know, something he always said that I still think is very true is that, you know, financial success is like 10% head knowledge and like 90% action. It's not so much knowing what to do, it's just doing it for a lot of people. And I think what you said is exactly right. Keeping things simple, keeping your overhead, you know, for your household as far as your expenses low, saving what you can, making wise choices. Long term, that drives most of your results. And these small things, the SEP IRA versus the solo 401k, in the grand scheme of things, you're right, they don't have a huge effect. But they're fun to talk about if you're like us.
Well, sure. I mean, and that said too, there was that big thing with the orthodontist that had $1 million of debt. And he told him, you know, you're going to sell everything. You're going to pay all the debt back. And it's like, okay, that's a $400,000 mistake if he does that.
Yeah, you can't take everything he says at face value. But as far as I think most financial success comes back to your point, which is just, it's not the knowing, it's the doing that really makes the difference.
And SEP IRA versus solo 401k. Honestly, that difference between those two is probably not the biggest deal, but the difference between, you know, a traditional IRA and one of those other two options, if you're self-employed, that could be a huge deal because you're talking about a limit of $6,000 for a traditional IRA, which anybody can set up without any complication, or you're doing the SEP if you're self-employed because it's easy and you can use, you know, a robo-advisor or Betterment to do it, and you can put, like you said, up to 50-something thousand in it if you have enough income to justify that.
For people that I probably just confused and irritated with that long explanation, I would think, you know, if you're going to do a backdoor Roth, do solo 401k. If you're not planning to do a backdoor Roth, just do a SEP and you'll be fine.
Man, it's amazing how much shorter our podcast could be, Ben. A lot of our people file their taxes separately because FedLoan just tells everybody, you know, tell the government your husband or wife is beating you. Say that you can't access their income and just commit fraud. That's easier, right? I'm joking a little bit, but that's kind of how it feels someday, you know. And there's this totally legitimate way that you can exclude your spouse's income from your student loan payments, which is sign up for pay-as-you-earn or income-based repayment, and then just file your taxes separately. But what are some things that you lose and what kind of penalties do people deal with, you know, kind of at a ninth grade level, let's keep it there, you know, when you're when you're filing your taxes, married filing separately?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing to start out with is it really just depends on your situation. So if you're really contemplating, you know, whether or not you should do married filing separately or not, I would either, you know, run the numbers yourself for your situation or talk to an accountant that can run them. It's not that complicated, but just at a high level view, you're losing some deductions and sometimes like childcare credits, childcare deductions, you're losing some student loan deductions. It has an effect on how you itemize versus standardized deductions. I mean, there's just some technicalities, but kind of the bottom line is you just want to run the numbers for your individual situation. You know, sometimes I've seen numbers where it makes sense, where, you know, it might cost you $2,000 more to file separately versus filing jointly, but you save $5,000 in your student loan payment. So you get ahead $3,000 a year by doing that strategy. So it makes sense. I've seen other strategies where it just kind of washes out. You just want to run the numbers for your situation based on yours and your spouse's income and then make a decision based off of that.
And that's really one of our biggest strengths, especially now back to the way it was when we started in 2016. You know, we're pretty good at explaining the student loan cost of things and giving you a very rough estimate of what you might want to talk to your CPA about how much it might cost you to do separate and just give you kind of an idea of that. One thing that we have discussed at length that we think is okay to do is to amend your taxes. So if you're separate, basically the rule is that you always have to have your most recent tax return be married filing separately. So for example, you filed separately in 2018, your certification here is coming up in January 2020, and you don't have your 2019 done yet. So you basically filed separately in 2018, so you use that return, and then you file your 2019 return married filing separately. Once you've done that, now you can go back and amend your 2018 return from separate to joint and potentially get any money back that you might have cost yourself in higher taxes. Now, the idea behind that is that your most recent return, as long as it is the most recent one, always says married filing separate, then that older return is kind of past the point of potentially getting you in trouble, is the theory. So it's a little bit of a gray area. Can you explain to people what I'm even talking about amending a tax return and why somebody might want to do it in the first place?
I don't have a lot of experience, truthfully, in doing this specific strategy, so I can't really speak to exactly how it works. I think, you know, amending in general is just you're going back in prior years where you filed a return and correcting it for whatever reason. There's a group that we've partnered with, and I forget the firm's name, but they specialize in optimizing student loan payments versus, you know, filing separately. I forget what the firm's called. What is it, Travis?
Yeah, we can say that. So studentloanplanner.com/tax. You just visit that URL, it'll take you to their website. It's like student loan tax experts, and folks that mention that Student Loan Planner referred them get a 10% discount, I think, until the end of January on their tax services for this year. And then there's a smaller discount after that point. I definitely would suggest using them if you don't already have a good CPA that's affordable, that can run these married filing separate and joint numbers and do community property returns and things like that.
Yeah. So to answer your question, I don't have a good answer for that specific strategy, but I would reach out to them because I feel like based on what I've seen of them, they've seen the strategy work before. I would talk to them and see what they say.
I think it's an okay strategy. I think that I used to be very, very hesitant to suggest that until I talked to a council of other student loan experts around the country. I was at a conference. We were just talking about all kinds of different strategies that we all use and whether or not we thought they were legitimate and backing them up and, you know, kind of attacking them and things like that. And this was one of the ones that came up. And once I thought through it a lot, I thought, well, you know, as long as the return that you used at the time was the return, right? You're not committing any fraud or anything. You literally had a separate return at that time. You kept it separate until you have a new tax return that you filed separate. And so in other words, the most recent return that you're basing it off of is always separate. So then that's not really fraudulent. That's just a loophole. That was kind of the discussion where it kind of landed. If you wanted to be super conservative, you're allowed to go back and amend tax returns up to 3 years in the past. Is that right, Ben?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that 3 years in the past, like calendar years, or is that tax years?
Three prior tax years.
Tax years. So what you could do is instead of amending 2018 in January 2020, what you could do is in January 2021, you could go back and amend 2018 at that point.
Yes, I think it's definitely potential. I'm just going to claim ignorance on it just because I haven't seen it work. But I think in theory, it's worth exploring for the right situation.
And that's the other thing too, is like some of the strategies that we give our clients, like it's very cut and dry. Like we know the stuff works, you know, and some of the times it's a gray area. And for gray areas, right, it's like a developing thing. Like these are loopholes and there's new loopholes that come up and we try to think through them. And that's why I'm so grateful that we have more people on the team and more people with different backgrounds on the team, because it's not just me interpreting this stuff. You know, we actually even have like a group of us online that we have a experts group that we bounce ideas off of each other just to make sure we're giving people good advice. And so if we think that something is kind of iffy, we'll let you know and we'll tell you like, this is the argument for it. This is the argument against it. This is something that we can't stand behind as a company, like supporting you on and saying that this is something that we would do. But sometimes we'll say, this is something that if you feel comfortable with this interpretation, then you should use it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if we think something's fraudulent, we'll tell you that too. I mean, like what our readers have told me that FedLoan has been recommending of saying you can't access your spouse's income and doing repay, you know, that is a example of a fraudulent strategy, we think. So it's important to differentiate between things that are black and white, gray, and definitely no-goes. Now, when you equally distribute income in a community property state, we term this the breadwinner loophole. And there's also, you know, the reverse breadwinner loophole for people that are living in places like California and Texas. Can you say as a CPA, like, is that something that was ever covered or discussed in your curriculum? And had you heard about that strategy before, say just for taxes, you know, not for student loans? Have you ever heard of that happening before?
No, I hadn't, but I was in Tennessee. And so we weren't a community property state there, and then also Kentucky. So I wasn't exposed to community property state laws that often. But yeah, looking back, I mean, you know, as we kind of talk through it, as I've seen circumstances with Student Loan Planner with some of these clients, yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely legitimate in that it totals the household income and then it divides it by two. And that's just the way that the state's laws work. And so you're just following those laws. And in some cases, it can create an advantage. Basically, where, you know, if you've got a spouse who, let's say you've got one spouse that's making $100,000, another spouse that's making $50,000. The spouse that's making $100,000 on a community property state tax return, they're actually only going to report $75,000 worth of taxable income. So they've effectively changed from $100,000 income down to $75,000 income. And, you know, as far as I can tell, I mean, it's completely legitimate because they're just following state laws as far as distribution of income.
And federal returns too, right?
Yeah, because federal returns are following the state law that that couple resides in.
Right. And so I think that's really interesting. And what fascinates me is what that basically tells you is that every student loan borrower who owes more than $100,000 that lives, you know, in Texas, Arizona, California, Washington State, you know, et cetera, all these places that are community property states, basically every single one of them who's married needs a plan, because you do that analysis and you think you don't have to worry about it, but then you end up making a huge mistake and you're not even aware of it. I can't ever tell somebody for sure that we're going to find something they're not aware of when they like work with us, you know, but it's like, okay, if you're in one of these states, like one of these nine states, like there's almost like a 90% certainty if you have a spouse that earns a lot less than you do and the spouse has no student loans that you're going to make a mistake without thinking this through. In an extreme case, I mean, consider, you know, like a dentist or a physician making $300,000 in a private practice in California, right? Has $400,000 of loans, which is a super common case. And let's say they're married to, you know, a teacher or, you know, a counselor or social worker, some sort of combo like that's fairly common. Then you look at that split in income. And so you might have like one person's making 50, one person's making 300. Well, that's $350,000 combined. Well, instead of paying on 350 or whatever, $300,000 of income, whatever I said, you know, they could be paying on 175. And so something that was a very clear refinancing case where they'd have to feel comfortable paying $4,000 a month, instead they can be paying like 12, 13, 1500 a month. That's really quite a big deal. And it's just, again, another example of why I was like, well, you know what? Like at the end of the day, if we have somebody on our team that's a CPA, it's going to make us a lot better because, you know, if there's ever any question, at least we have somebody that has some training. I'm not going to say that you know all the tax rules. Obviously, no one can know that. But certainly somebody with at least a background that knows how to, you know, understand what this form is saying a little bit better than I do.
Yeah, you've done a great job, though. It's really specific to student loans as far as how this can be such an advantage. But yeah, it just comes back to your point that you really have to run those numbers to really understand what your situation, you know, how it could benefit from some of these different rules.
Let's ask a little bit more simple question. What is AGI? What does that mean?
It stands for adjusted gross income. It's your total income for that year, your total taxable income before any type of itemized standard deduction.
So I have $200,000 of AGI and I have $100,000 that I donated to charity. Does that mean my AGI is $200,000 or $100,000?
So it'd still be $200,000 because that itemized deduction would come later. So your adjusted gross income would still be $200,000. So, you know, there's a few deductions that go into AGI, but for the most part, I think the easy way to think about it is just the total taxable income that you're making on an annual basis, that's going to be close to your AGI.
There's things called above the line deductions, right? What does that mean?
Above the line deductions, they're just specific deductions that come into play before the AGI is computed. And so student loan interest deduction, that's one. If you contribute to a SEP, that's one. There used to be one for moving expenses. So there's like, I don't know, there's six or seven, I think, above the line deductions that are very specific that will subtract from your gross income to get you to your adjusted gross income. But for most people, it doesn't move the needle. In a lot of circumstances, if you're an employee, basically, you know, what you make, your gross income is what ends up being your AGI on your tax return, or very close to it.
And that's kind of one of the reasons why we're after people to contribute so much to retirement accounts, because that's one of the few above the line deductions that you get. And so that means that, you know, it comes into play before they calculate that AGI number, and that's the number they use to calculate your student loan payment. So a lot of times people are confused a little bit about that. I think, you know, they're thinking like, okay, I'll just buy a big house, or maybe I'll contribute to charity and I'll get a lower student loan payment. No, it doesn't really work like that.
That's a very good point. So yeah, if you've got $100,000 income and you put in $10,000 your 401k, your gross wages as far as the tax return is concerned is only $90,000. So you're exactly right. There's definitely a benefit to contributing to retirement accounts.
Most of our people make somewhere in the neighborhood of like 70 to 200K. Like that's kind of like our typical person. But, you know, we do have some very high income earners listening too. Some of those people might be kind of on the fence about putting money into their student loans versus putting it into more retirement accounts. And some of the people are practice owners and own their own businesses. Can you explain what is a defined, like a self-funded defined benefit plan? And just, you know, in terms of lowering your AGI, what's like the range that you can put into one of those plans to lower your AGI by?
Yeah. So again, full disclosure, I've never actually set one of these up, so I don't have direct experience, but basically at a high level, they're a pension plan. So like with a 401k in 2019, you can put it up to, let's say, 19,000 deferred per year. It goes in an account and it's invested, and whatever it grows to or it shrinks to is what you've got to retire on. With a pension, it works more like Social Security in that you put in X amount of dollars and it goes to an insurance company. And an insurance company basically guarantees that when you reach 65 years old, for example, they're going to pay you X amount of dollars per month for the rest of your life. And so because it's an actual pension plan and not like a defined contribution plan, the limits can be much higher. It's based on how old you are. So the older you are, the more you can contribute. So it really makes the most sense for someone who's a practice owner. It's like 55, 60 years old. And they're really wanting to put back, I've seen, you know, six figures in some cases. If you're a young practice owner, it's defined by an actuary. So it's a really complex formula, but you're not going to be able to put back most likely six figure amount. It's going to be lower just because of the way that formula works.
Yeah, I've heard people throw around numbers like when you're in your 30s, you can maybe put away as much as 100 grand. In 40s, it's like 200 grand. And then 50s and 60s, it can be 200 to even 300 grand.
It sounds a little higher than I realize, but again, I don't have direct. I've never had someone who was willing to put back that much money.
Yeah.
But that could be the case. There's some specific companies that kind of deal with those funding type options and they can run the numbers. You know, if you're a practice owner who's really wanting to put back the maximum amount of money and, you know, even six figures is palatable to you, then I would look at some of these companies and let them run the numbers and tell you how it could work.
Yeah. I mean, because remember, if in terms of financial independence, right, if you have enough assets where you can spend 4% of those assets and you can live off of that, then you pretty much don't have to work unless you want to. And then on top of that, if you also have student loans, you also need a couple hundred thousand in a brokerage account to cover the student loan tax hit too, if you're not doing PSLF. What that can do for somebody is one of the common questions that I get is like, okay, well, this is good, Travis. You're telling me that I need to do this forgiveness plan, but what happens if I make too much money one day? Like, what happens if I'm making like $500,000 because I'm super successful in my practice and then suddenly I have all this interest and I'm screwed because I'm going to have to refinance and I'm going to have to pay it all down? And it's like, well, actually, no, you're not screwed. Like, if you're starting off, you're a practice owner and you're 30 and then, like, you know, you do 5-10 years as a practice owner and you're just really killing it and you're 40 years old or something, then you could do one of these pension plans if you're feeling like you're going to stay in this community and continue to make a really high income for a long time. And you might stash away millions of dollars for retirement and still get your student loans forgiven because you're writing off your AGI that way.
Yeah, in the right circumstances, absolutely, it could definitely be a tool.
So, I mean, the key part is, like, regardless if you're that 60K social worker that owns her own practice, or if you're, you know, a orthodontist making 400 to 500K, like, regardless of what income level you're in with that, the one commonality is if you have student loans, one, they don't need to affect your life that bad if you know how to handle them. And then you can save a lot more for your future than you thought you could afford to, right?
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, you might have a couple interesting examples to share with our listeners about some clients, just some fun success stories. Maybe you can just kind of, you know, anonymize things to sort of share some of your experiences so far.
So I think one of the best for me, it was a couple, the husband was disabled and the wife was a teacher. And they had, I'm just kind of recalling here, I think they had about 80,000 in student loans. We were basically able to go through the numbers and show them that, you know, they went through the PSLF process, they would have that 80,000 or so forgiven in the next 10 years. And because her income was low enough as a teacher, I think she was only going to pay in a total of, let's say, like $20,000. And so, you know, they basically were going to have thousands of dollars in savings on those loans. They weren't really aware of that being a true option. They knew it was maybe on the table, but they hadn't seen the numbers actually kind of laid out in an Excel spreadsheet like we went through. And I think just the relief that I heard over the phone, it made my day. So that was probably one of my best stories.
Those are always great, especially when somebody has huge savings that wasn't aware about it at all. You know, a lot of times, like, our consults will be somebody who's really familiar with everything, and well, we might find something that they didn't know about, and it'll still might save them five figures, right? But, you know, a lot of times the people who are the kind of folks that, like, going back to my earlier example, like the people that don't want to play the 5-hour board game version of financial planning, right? Like, they just want to play, you know, Sorry or Aggravation, or I guess that's probably a dated game, but, you know, they want the quick one, right? The quick game, Candyland, play Candyland, right? Those are the folks that we really find the huge savings for. So, you know, when can people book you, right? So I guess Ben at Student Loan Planner is your email, right?
Yes.
So you could certainly reach out that way if you specifically wanted to work with Ben. But Ben, you're doing what segment for our clients and what days are you working for us?
The segment is $0 to $200,000 in student loan debt. So normally that's, most people are $100,000, $150,000 is kind of the average case that I've seen so far. I do consults on every Tuesday and Thursday from like 8:30 to 4:30 Central Time.
So if you want to work with Ben specifically and you owe less than 200 grand, then you know you can book him. If you just book that main link at studentloanplanner.com/help, then you could just go there and just book that below 200K link for Tuesday or Thursday if you have that amount of debt. Now, obviously, Ben, with your background, tax background, physician focus, we obviously hope that we bump you up in the future and you're working with all segments and not just the folks with our quote unquote modest debt loads.
It's all relative, yeah.
It's all relative, exactly. So I do certainly think that you will be advising all of our clients pretty soon. We just like to kind of start people off in the smaller debt segments because I don't know if we lost anybody when we were talking about those defined benefit to 300K like AGI reduction tips, but like things get really complicated the more and more you go up the income ladder, you know, and the more you go up the debt ladder, things can get really complicated. And so not to say that they're not complicated in that zero to 200K segment either, but we really try to focus on growing folks and just growing their expertise so that when you're booking the 400K and up segment, you know, you're going to get Ben a year from now and Ben's going to have done, you know, 500 consults, right? Instead of 50 something. So that's kind of the business strategy behind that. So a couple other last things to share here. That tax link, if you want to get the good tax deal locked in, go to studentloanplanner.com/tax. They actually do 30-minute free chats with folks about whether or not it makes sense to work together. So there's kind of a risk-free thing. And then you get the discount if you mention Student Loan Planner as the referral source. Also, it's a great time of year in 2020 to figure out what you're doing with your student loans. We do the strategy part, which is, you could say that is the most important part of all this. So if you want to work with Ben or me or any of our other consultants, again, studentloanplanner.com/help. And Ben, a little final question for you. What's your favorite board game?
So I've got a four-year-old little girl. I would say it'd have to be Candyland to play with her. I think overall, Catan was one that we enjoyed like when I was before kids. That was a lot of fun. We'd always spend too much time on it though.
Yeah, so you're telling me that after you have kids, Candyland's all you have time for basically.
Candyland and Disney movies, that's it.
Oh, shoot.
I mean, it's not all bad, but it's just different.
Yeah, if we're doing our jobs right, we try to make finances as easy as Candyland is to play, right? That's how we know we're doing a good job. Thank you, Ben, so much for being on the show, and thank you for being one of the newer members on the team.
Yeah, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to today's show. If you're ready to schedule your custom student loan plan, visit studentloanplanner.com/book and pick a time that works for you. The show notes are available at studentloanplanner.com/the number of today's episode. Finally, if you love your Student Loan Planner podcast, help us out and leave us a review or share it with someone who owes more than you.